Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Tonight's show features an update on the measles outbreak in Pennsylvania, and then the federal administration, the Justice Department, I hope you heard the air quotes, a truly colossal kicking the healthcare system while it's down event is in progress that will impact healthcare for generations. After that, we're taking a hike all over neurology and brain research to explore recent discoveries and their implication, plus some curious things you probably didn't know about Tylenol. So we'll take a look behind the scenes of efforts that are being made in Pennsylvania to try and put a lid on this outbreak. It's really significant, and it is accelerating. The outbreak began in late April, and it's doing that good old geometric progression we got so familiar with back in 2020. So far, we have 540 people who have contracted measles in the current outbreak. That's as of today. That's the official. And I want to remind you that all official counts are officially undercounts, because that's the people who showed up in a healthcare setting and were reported. So it does not really cover all of those asymptomatic cases. But here's why I'm saying geometric progression. 119 new cases reported in the last week. In a year, this is the highest number of measles cases in 35 years. And most people are saying, take that number and multiply by 3 in order to get a real idea of the outbreak. And we're hitting into fall and winter. School has started. And there's some features of measles that really create a problem for that sort of thing. Chiefly, measles can spread for 4 days before the rash appears, and for 4 days after. And during that initial time, it spreads even before you get the runny nose. It looks like a cold for those 4 days until you see the rash, maybe a little fever. That's one problem. The other is that the virus can remain suspended in the air for up to 2 hours. So doctor's offices, dentist's offices, clinics, hospitals need to create detailed protocols to evaluate, isolate, and treat patients. Sometimes that involves having a separate entrance for possible measles cases. But I want to point out, they're not doing anything in the schools. They aren't like sending kids home who have fevers or runny noses. Maybe they should be, but they aren't. And so we can expect that this thing is just going to blossom now that kids are back in school. And researchers and health department officials are doing their best. They've given more than 5,700 MMR vaccines across Pennsylvania this year, and that 600 of those doses were in Lancaster County, which is the hot spot for this measles epidemic. And that 600 is more than triple the number that was given in 2025, to get an idea of the under vaccination in that area. And I'm not here to blame the people who aren't getting vaccinated. I'm here to encourage them to get vaccinated. And if you want to get someone to do something, criticizing them as the first thing out of your mouth is probably not a good idea. Some families, in fact, are seeking early doses. This can be the measles vaccine can be given to infants between 6 and 12 months in an outbreak, and it does provide some protection. But the first dose is typically given between 12 and 15 months. That's because the maternal antibodies will deactivate a lot of the vaccine. This is a live virus vaccine, so it will deactivate. Another problem with this is it's a live virus vaccine. So if a woman is unvaccinated, then and she's pregnant, she can't be vaccinated, as the outbreak comes through. If she catches it from her older children, the in utero infant, the embryo can, the fetus can catch it, and the fetus can, and that can cause swelling. That's thought to be the cause of death of the one infant who died. Autopsy showed that the spleen had ruptured. And, of course, we're arguing, had it ruptured or was it lacerated? I'm sorry. Babies don't, babies get enlarged spleens. If you're a term fetus, you're going to get the enlarged spleen. If you then go through the birth canal, all that huffing and puffing and twisting and pressure is possibly going to cause the spleen to pop. That's going to look just like a laceration. That child had measles at birth. I don't think there's any argument that measles was the cause. We're getting lost in semantics. And we've got drop-offs in vaccination rates in the counties, all of that in Pennsylvania, but especially Lancaster County. Now, you need about 95% coverage in your pediatric population before to keep from getting an outbreak. Well, this year they're down to 87%, and yep, they're getting trouble. In fact, doctors and health department officials are actually going out to, they're doing pop-up vaccination clinics at churches. They're going to people's homes and hand-delivering vaccines. It reminds me of some of the concerted vaccination efforts that are done in Africa and in Central and South America, up in the highlands, because that's, you've got to get this vaccine to the people, and it makes a huge difference. Every person who, the R number on measles is 14. So in terms of the number of people who will get measles from, on the average, from someone who has measles is 14. The highest the R number got on COVID, I think at its peak, was maybe 3, you know, literally 1/5 that of measles, and we took that one pretty seriously. This disease does kill children, and back before we had a vaccine, it killed 1 in 5,000 children as they went through measles epidemics. If they caught measles, the death rate was 1 out of 5,000. Okay, I mentioned that the federal government is doing something really bad. Let me just say that we do not need more dermatologists. We just need primary care docs in this country. And almost like they're targeting the medical schools that are enrolling students who are likely to be willing to be primary care doctors, who are likely to serve in underserved communities. Those are the places where we have the worst situation. Out in the country, in the poorer areas of California, even if it's in a city, the Treasury Department and the IRS last week proposed stripping tax-exempt status from private schools if they consider race in admissions and other policies. And there have been a series of investigations launched, basically threatening tax-exempt status of organizations like UCLA. This started about a year ago. UCLA was sued in civil litigation, which charging that it discriminated based on race. In January of this year, the Justice Department joined the suit, which means free lawyers. And the agency asks the court to terminate all federal grants to UCLA and order the school to return all federal grant money received since 2023. That would effectively close UCLA as a university, UCLA Medical School. It would be an amazing blow. The word has been out for a while. In 2023, the American Academy of Medical Colleges basically, you know, as soon as Trump got into office, they've been going after DEIB. They've been going off after race-conscious admissions and saying, well, you're not admitting as many white people and you're admitting, or Asians, you're admitting more brown-skinned people from various locations, and we don't like that, and we're going to put a stop to it by pulling your funding. Even if these schools adopt race-neutral policies, if they are going to try and admit people who are going to stay in the community and who are going to go into pediatrics and go into primary care, that's a different person than someone who's going to go into dermatology or go into interventional radiology and move across the country to a tertiary medical center. And those are not the people we need to be spending our money in educating. Oh, by the way, they're coming after my alma mater, Davis, as well, for exactly the same crime against humanity. So my idea is that pulling at a point when we have a healthcare shortage, which is going to get worse before it gets better, slowing the pipeline for new doctors is an atrocity for everyone, okay? And it's just so wrong and so misaligned with the safety needs of the population of this country, but it's serving a political purpose. And I did not expect this sort of thing to happen in my country. I'll just leave it at that. We've said enough on the topic. Let's move on. Some curious things you probably didn't know about Tylenol. Now, I was looking at a PowerPoint that one of my patients shared with me, and she picked up on this and said, well, would you maybe like to use that in the show? And I thought, well, yeah, send it to me and we'll see. It's a non-trivial finding that Tylenol actually reduces social pain. This was a study that did come out of UCLA. While we're in the news, they do a lot of really great neurological research. And this was UCLA, Toronto, Florida State, and the UCLA group is led by Eisenberger, and they have a social pain lab. And this is a group that studies the effects of social pain like rejection and exclusion and othering and ridicule and all of these things, using neuroimaging to see exactly what's going on in the brain and trying to tease apart the structures that become involved in a situation like this. So the setup here was that they had a game that the undergraduate students, because it's always undergraduate students if you're doing a study like this, they come cheap. And they had an MRI available, so they would have them play a game in which they were essentially socially excluded. Think some sort of some version of musical chairs with ridicule thrown in if you don't get your chair. And they looked at the neuroimaging, and what they saw was increased activity in the pain centers, in a section of the pain called the dorsal nucleus accumbens and the anterior cortex of the limbic system. And this is abbreviated DACC, but it's right there deep in the brain where you're going to have a lot of emotions and a lot of reflex reactions from pain, and social pain apparently hurts in the same place as the anterior insula and the DACC. So that was a finding that was the first part of the study. Then, because we know that acetaminophen relieves pain by slowing the activity of the DACC, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, then what we did was give them acetaminophen and see if it impacted their negative response to the game. And they had a placebo trial, and what they saw was people who took the acetaminophen were less wounded by the social wounding that was taking place. Now, this was widely, this is back in 2010, it was widely picked up. And in Ohio State, they took it a bit further in a 2016 study. They studied it further, but they also found that acetaminophen doesn't just blunt felt social pain, but also blunts your empathy for other people's pain and in general, your general effect of reactivity, including your reaction to positive stimuli. And so this study found that acetaminophen reduced perceived pain and personal distress when reading about others' physical and social pain. And the companion experiment found that acetaminophen reduced empathic concern for people being in physical or social pain. Now, this study, I believe, was not an MRI study. I believe it was just a questionnaire study. But an independent group did an EEG replication attempt, and they found that people who'd taken acetaminophen had a change in their DACC and their anterior insula, which is really cool. So now you've got an MRI and an EEG source. So it's probably true to a certain extent. So a 2025 systemic review says acetaminophen is one of the few pharmacological behavioral interventions with reasonable support. What else has support? Mindfulness training and psilocybin. But again, the studies are not great and can't be mushed together for a analysis combining the studies, which a macro analysis is something we love to do to try to improve the statistical significance. But the studies need to be reasonably coherent and alike before you can reasonably put their data together to get that lovely statistical significance. And you always have to look at psychology research and say, well, look at replication, which is why I did that and did go searching to see. So softness, but I think that probably there's going to be a variable response from person to person. So my suggestion to the audience is if you're heading into something where you'd rather, where you're anticipating being made upset, let's say Thanksgiving dinner where you have red state and blue state relatives trying to eat the same turkey. That might be a good time to pop an extra strength Tylenol on it, or acetaminophen. I honestly think that there are moments when blunting is a reasonable idea. Now, don't do that if you're planning to drink a ton, because acetaminophen and alcohol do not mix. But if you are a non-drinker and you're looking to take the edge off social pain, Tylenol might do the job. Let me know if you try it and think it works, because in placebo studies, it does seem to work. We've all experienced the Ozempic craze in the last few years with the GLP-1 drugs. Technically, these are peptides, and I've been talking about peptides for the last few shows. And GLP-1 is a hormone, but it's a small molecule, so it counts as a peptide. And drug makers are now just slavering, or chomping at the bit is another expression, but they can't wait because a whole series of new peptides are coming down the track, the orexins. Now, orexins are neurotransmitters that carry messages between neurons. But one of the main jobs of these particular neurotransmitters is to regulate wakefulness. And there's a whole bunch of new drugs designed to mimic their effects approaching the market. So on August 5th this year, Takeda's drug, which is called Oveporexton, I'm sure they'll come up with a better name, don't worry, it'll be catchy, is the first orexin agonist. In other words, it is going to help people stay awake. It will be approved for narcolepsy, and we'll get into narcolepsy in a minute, but actually it's directly hitting the thing that is broken in narcolepsy. Meanwhile, Eli Lilly, who has done rather well on this latest peptide craze, is hoping, just bought a biotech company that has an early drug. And they spent about $8 billion on the deal. And that's probably because Morgan Stanley anticipates that orexin medicines could generate $16 billion a year from narcolepsy and sleep disorders. It's essentially going to help you stay awake, like Montelukast, which is being used by a lot of people in, well, colleges, startups, anywhere where you need to do 14, 16 hours days and then get up and do it again, are using these drugs off-label. Orexins is, narcolepsy is rare, okay, 1 in 2,000 people, but there is evidence these drugs could help with attention, motivation, help the brain's reward system normalize itself. And these orexins were discovered a long time ago, and I'm not sure how much detail to go into, but I think this is a nice, obscure, fun fact. The doctor who discovered them was studying hereditary narcolepsy in Doberman pinschers and Labrador retrievers. Both breeds are prone to suddenly collapsing mid-play. And he found that there was a mutation that blocked the brain's ability to respond to orexins. And then about that same year, Yan Nagisawa's lab also found, you know, established this. So two people discovered it basically in the same year. And human confirmation, narcoleptic patients have lost the specialized neurons that produce orexins. These neurons inhibit the hypothalamus. So they lock onto the receptor in the hypothalamus that is important for maintaining wakefulness. So we have already a sleeping pill that blocks orexins. So if you block the wakefulness, you get the sleepfulness. But finding agents that actually fit into and stimulate a receptor is actually much harder than finding agents that sort of fit into, kind of, and jam the receptor. The orexins are going to be a big deal. And the most important thing I think here is it's not just, obviously, insomnia will be a side effect. And but the drugs that we have are like methylphenidate and Adderall, but all of which are being used, you know, in tons off-label, are much less likely to be long-term successful. So, of course, will these drugs develop resistance or over time? Tachyphylaxis is the technical term for that. But the orexin agonists so far seem to produce a more natural and stable wakefulness, fewer side effects, and less potential for abuse, certainly than stimulants. And I haven't seen anything head-to-head. Also, they may work for ADHD. There's another orexin stimulator that's being looked at for that. And they may hit the jackpot with the sleep apnea market on this. And, you know, can you imagine taking a pill that would prevent sleep, that would keep you from having to use a CPAP? I have no idea how that's going to work, presumably waking up the muscles in the throat without, but putting to sleep the brain, and waking up the brain as well. Can't quite figure out how that's going to work for sleep apnea, but stay tuned, because as soon as something is published that is not too technical and that I can't grok it, I will be sure to bring it right to you. Hello, this is Dr. Don. You're on the air. Hi, I get your name and where you're calling from, please?
John from Santa Cruz.
Okay, John from Santa Cruz, you have the floor.
I wanted to switch the subject from drugs to school. Mm-hmm. And I believe that whatever our interest is, school should be free until the time we get a workable degree that says, okay, you can go out and practice this now. Like all the schooling you went through with college through graduate through med school, that should have all been free because it lets you get out there and participate in something that really is of interest to you, given that you do have that interest. But taking it down to, let's say, third, fourth to sixth grade, I think everybody should be required to take at least three different languages in that formidable year take, in that if you can take three different languages throughout that time period, you get to look and feel how other people assess things. And I think it would make it a peaceful world, more peaceful world than not understanding everybody around you, in as much as the endeavor of grade school, middle school, high school, college. It's not only do you learn things academically, but you learn things socially. And if you can learn things socially from somebody who speaks, let's say, English or Spanish or Filipino, whatever, I think your view of the world, Micah, people, they might say, well, I didn't realize you could think like that. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those things where I heard something that they wanted to give people funding to go into an area that they might like, but with this caveat, in as much as they said, if you look, if you're going to go into an area that's going to make you more money than you would have otherwise not been able to, wouldn't have been able to bank more money, we aren't going to fund it. I think that's ridiculous because in the... Yeah.
John, I want to stop you for just a moment and echo approval of what you've said. One of the things that they do in France for medical training, I spent a year as an undergraduate there, and they, first of all, education is subsidized by the government in France, and they're so you, if you go to a French, state-run university, it's free, and you actually get a food allowance, no housing allowance, but believe me, if the tuition and the food are covered, you can get by. And medical school is also free. But after you graduate from a state-run medical school, you owe hours of medical service every, for the rest of the time that you're working as a doctor. So that community service is baked in as essentially your loan repayment. And I think something like that might, the community service aspect, I think, could be framed not just in medicine, but a lot of different professions, things like accounting, computer science. There's all sorts of ways. If you get your degree in dance, then you have to do, you have to go out and do free performances for community groups. And so it, first of all, it creates a sense of appropriately being connected and owing something. You were given something, you owe something back. And I was lucky enough to get a lot of what were called National Defense Student Loans, which were set up in the late 50s, early 60s after Sputnik went up. And they took a look at American children's math scores and science scores, and they said, we're going to have to do something about that. So they established, if you went into a scientific profession, you would get these loans, and they were very low percentage. And this is back, I was getting these loans when interest rates were at 18%. That was back, during the last time interest rates were super high. And I was getting 2% loans. And once I started paying them off, you had like a 30 years to pay them off, which even if I hadn't finished medical school, I could have paid those loans off. And we need also for people who, change careers, they get to reset their loan if they don't finish, because sometimes people find themselves in the wrong place. But there are also people who aren't going to want to go to university. And we have to think about that group and how we're going to somehow make the situation equitable for everybody. So it's a complex issue. I totally agree with you with what you have to say about the languages. Early on, it's really important. And linguistics, if you study it at all, the words define your thought processes is essentially what linguistics is.
Yeah. And one other form of linguistics is music. It's a written language. It's a physical language. It's a rhythm language. So that should, my thought is it should be included in one of those languages. I have a friend that he was in Israel.
John, I think we're going to have to let you go.
Okay.
Thank you for the anecdotes and the opinion. And please keep listening.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so getting back to where we were, this is just an interesting little story. Have you ever wondered about what happens when you're, quote-unquote, put under for a surgical procedure? General anesthesia. So these researchers looked at what was going on, and it's very funny. We were just talking about music with John, so I'll use a music metaphor. Have you ever heard a bad student band, like, you know, middle school band that isn't very good or is just getting started, and of course they're moving new people in who aren't that good with their instruments, so there's a little off key and they're a little off beat, and then you compare that to, say, a championship band or a college band playing the same song, and, you know, it's very, very possible to tell the difference. Well, scientists have identified a distinctive brainwave pattern that marks the slide into unconsciousness during general anesthesia. And what they showed in their study was as anesthesia takes hold, several brain areas, which normally are coordinated, like the brass section and the drums in the orchestra, falter. They lose their connection with each other. We've been looking for non-behavioral correlates of consciousness for a long time, and think about people who've had a massive brain injury, and you're trying to decide if they're conscious. Well, now we have a signature that will tell us that. Also, it's going to allow anesthesiologists to fine-tune drug dosing and not have to just say, oh, well, your body weight is such and such, so we're going to give you this much. They can watch the brain go offline. And this is done by placing electrodes on the scalp, so it could be done with a cap, and you don't have to shave. They used really high-tech computer mathematical models to look at the signals coming from the 9 brain regions that are implicated in mediating consciousness. And basically what they found were that the top of the brain, about halfway between the forehead and the back of the skull, the occipital, which is the back of the head, and those deep structures, like we were talking about nucleus accumbens, well, just in front is the good old thalamus, also very involved in pain control, but involved in assigning meaning to pain. But it's also critical for consciousness. And so they used propofol as their anesthetic, because that will put people into anesthesia without interfering with their ability to breathe, and, well, unless you give them too much. And they found something they called the alpha band wave between the parietal area and the thalamus, and when they gave the anesthesia, this just evaporated. It's the orchestra lost, the band lost its drum, it didn't have its drum major, they were all playing the same tune, but they weren't playing it at the same time. So the parietal cortex and its communications with the frontal cortex turn out to be key in consciousness. Oh, and we do have a caller, so we'll put that one aside and pick up the call. Hello, this is Dr. Motika, and you are on the air. Can I have your name and where you're calling from?
Oh, yes. My name is Carrie, and as a grandmother, I would love to just ask you if there's anything that we can be doing for my 6-year-old granddaughter, who's our first grader,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the measles,
well,
and having such a bunch of kids around her every day.
Well, okay. First of all, has she had 2 measles shots?
Oh, I do not know that, but I guess I'm sure that mommy and daddy know that.
Okay, so assuming that she's had her two measles vaccinations, which are usually given at around 15 months and 4 years, and so they're pretty widely separated. But if she's had those two shots, she's got about she's very, very well protected. From severe measles, she's 100% protected. And she's about 98% protected from mild measles.
Okay, yes, she does have, if those are, you know, going back when she was much younger, yeah, she would have had all of those.
Okay, so really, from the standpoint of measles, you're pretty solid, and you don't have to worry about that. The chances that she would bring that home, and I'm sure the mother has been vaccinated as well. And by the way, if you know women who say, oh, I'm trying to get pregnant, make sure that you ask them if they've been vaccinated for measles in their life, because COVID for that matter, because you can't, if you get COVID while you're pregnant, you're way more likely to die. And if you get, and if you get measles while you're pregnant, you're way more likely to die. That's, you know, they say eating for two, well, you'll be dying for two. So let's not go there.
Okay. Well, thanks for mentioning that, because I will definitely not forget that.
Good. And thank you for your call, and God bless you for caring so much and calling in.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Don.
Bye-bye. So it's your breath. And, you know, ancient doctors used to smell breath. And they also looked at poop and tasted urine. And they were doing that to diagnose disease. Well, it turns out that what's going on in your breath can actually help us screen for something very serious, a medical condition called sepsis. And in sepsis, there are bacteria loose in the bloodstream, and the immune system just goes crazy. It fights fire with fire, but the bacteria are killed. And as they're killed, the body parts of the bacteria actually set up a chain reaction, which causes the capillary beds to collapse and fluid to leave the bloodstream and go out into the peripheral tissues, dropping the blood pressure and starving the heart, the kidneys, and the brain of blood and oxygen. That's sepsis, vascular collapse. And so when someone comes in and they have an infection, we would love to be able to predict if they were at risk for sepsis or a high probability of getting sepsis. And so researchers have been studying stool and breath samples from, in this case, children with asthma and children who didn't have asthma. And they found that there was quite a lot of variation in those two groups with the abundance of a particular bacteria, which increased the risk of asthma quite a bit. So they, here we are. So there were four molecules that they could test for that made a real difference in diagnosis here, and they are working now on sepsis, and this particularly will be useful in babies, because drawing blood cultures or drawing any kind of blood in babies is extremely difficult. But if we can identify those early sepsis markers that are essentially coming out of the blood, into the lungs, and out where you can access that air. So this could give us an early warning hours to days before the clinical signs of sepsis would occur, and it's particularly important in newborns. So we're going to roll with some microbiome stories for the last part. So let's talk about babies some more. When babies are born, they come through the birth canal, if they're born vaginally, and they're colonized with trillions of microbes. In fact, we think that some of the very smallest of the microbes actually get into the placenta from the mom. We're not sure how that happens, but they're allowed in, and actually some babies are born with a few of these bacteria in their digestive tracts and nose. But getting back to being born, in that process, the bacteria that are in the mother's vagina, are the baby's exposed to that, but most of the time there's also a bowel movement at birth, not from the, well, from the baby, sometimes from the mother, just about always. And that little bit of, or a lot of poop that gets squeezed out smears the baby. And this is actually the first inoculation of beneficial bacteria. Neonates are actually programmed to develop tolerance to friendly bacteria. And the maternal antibodies are transferred in utero and through the breast milk, and they have roles in protecting the newborns. But that first week of life, the immunoglobulins, the antibodies in the maternal milk, interact with these non-pathogenic bacteria, the mouth's microbiota that are supposed to be there in high amounts to regulate the immune response, prevent asthma, reduce food allergies, and regulate the immune system later on in adulthood to help limit autoimmune disease. All of this is going on in that first week of life. And that is a crucial period during which maternal antibodies literally retrain, you know, prevent the development of antibodies that you don't want and encourage the development of antibodies that you do want, or encourage, kind of, I'd say, but allow the antibodies to form for the bacteria that you do want, that you do want antibodies against. So it's a very, very sophisticated reaction. And we know that breastfeeding, the longer you breastfeed, the less chance of developing asthma. So those maternal antibodies have a solid improvement. That we have, that we have it for the asthma, which is easy enough to identify. But food sensitivities can have much more subtle injuries. And the idea here is that the maternal antibodies essentially set up that first developmental window while you're just getting breast milk. But as soon as you start eating actual food, you're going to be exposed to just tons of bacteria, and you need to have the ability to switch and start making antibodies so that you don't become infected with the small amounts of bacteria that are just invariably along for the ride in food. The most important part here is that is the pre-milk. So that's the colostrum. And we do know that the colostrum is an extremely important component of breast milk. And in women who are unable to breastfeed, we need to essentially find colostrum that we can give to those infants. Very important thing to be looking at as we go forward. The next story I have is going to be not about the microbiome, because we're too tight for time, but I want to spend a few moments talking about magnesium threonate. Magnesium L-threonate is a compound that was created essentially to get magnesium into the brain. And it's very easily absorbed across the blood-brain barrier. I think it's actively transported. And recent studies have shown that if you take about a gram of this at bedtime, you get better deep and REM sleep. And in the following morning, you'll score higher on measures of alertness, energy, and productivity, and improved mood. So pretty solid benefit there. This drug does not actually have an upper limit. Unless you get diarrhea, then you should stop, because you're not absorbing it across the bloodstream, so it's not going to get to your brain anyway. But I have one patient who's a real success story for her ADD. It has to be 10 years ago. I put her on this just to help with sleep and to help with anxiety, which it also does. and she found that it improved her ADD. She started taking 3 grams a day of that and was able to stop all of her ADD medications and concentrate and have no side effects, and her gut tolerated it just fine. Other studies have shown that magnesium can reduce migraine severity, and this particular magnesium, the magnesium threonate, I'll spell that, magnesium L-threonate. You can find that at your local health food store. If you have migraines, you might want to try it. If you have ADD and you're wanting to have something kinder and gentler, if you're hoping to improve your sleep, especially deep sleep as you age, I would encourage all of you to seek this out and give it a trial. So we'll end the program with a little bit of news you can use, a little bit of good advice, and I'll be back with more science stories and good advice next week here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.